If you had to build a historical monument right now, like let's say you've been tasked with commemorating a massive world-altering revolution, what materials would you use?
Oh man, that's a big question.
Right. Seriously, take a second and just think about what that looks like in your head. Because if you're like most of us, your instinctive answer probably involves, well, a towering structure.
Definitely.
Maybe, 100 tons of bronze cast into some guy on a horse, or just gigantic slabs of marble piled incredibly high. I mean, think of the Washington Monument or Mount Rushmore.
Or those brutalist concrete structures that take up like half a city square, right? The ones that just cast a massive shadow over everything around them. We really seem to have this collective obsession with sheer volume.
Yes. Exactly. There is this deeply ingrained cultural reflex that we all share. We basically directly tie the importance of an event to the massive physical size of the structure that remembers it.
We do, yeah.
A monument, almost by definition, is supposed to dominate the skyline. It's designed to make you feel small, to, force you to crane your neck backward just to take it all in. We think heavy history requires heavy stone.
Right, and it's an almost inevitable association in our minds because physical monumentality has, it's always been the baseline language of power. I mean, we see it constantly in classical architecture, in urban design, even in the layout of ancient temples. We just sort of operate on this assumption that for a legacy to endure time and, human forgetfulness, it needs to visually and physically crush its surrounding environment.
But today, we're going to completely dismantle that assumption. We are taking a deep dive into a painting titled Sri Panchatattva by the artist Jairo Duque, and we're pairing it with his incredibly exhaustive technical and philosophical notes.
Which is just fascinating.
They really are. And just to set the stage for you listening, our mission today is not to boringly describe colors on a canvas like some sort of audio textbook.
No, absolutely not. Staying on the surface wouldn't do this piece or the artist's intentions any justice at all.
Right.
Our goal here is to decode how a single image with surprisingly modest dimensions can translate an incredibly complex philosophy of consciousness, while at the same time delivering a very sharp, very urgent critique of our modern world.
Okay, let's unpack this because the foundational concept the artist introduces, like right out of the gate in his texts, is this idea of symbolic density.
Such a great term.
I just love the gravity of that phrase.
Me.
Duque is basically redefining what a monument can be. He proposes that a true monument isn't measured by the square footage it takes up on a wall or, the tonnage of the stone.
Right, it's not about the sheer mass.
Exactly. It's measured by the specific weight of its message. It's about its ability to condense centuries of history into a format that is immediately accessible to the human eye.
Yeah, he is setting out to prove that a well-articulated symbol can carry an enormous monumental load without needing the scale of a skyscraper.
So to really understand how this painting achieves that symbolic density, we first have to ground ourselves in its physical reality. Because the modest size of this piece isn't just some limitation the artist bumped up against.
No, not at all. It is a highly deliberate provocation.
Right. Let's help you visualize exactly what we're looking at. The physical piece is an acrylic painting on canvas. Specifically, Duque noted he used Liquitex acrylics, and it's painted in a vertical format of 24 by 30 inches. So for those of you using the metric system, that is just over half a meter tall.
Which means, I mean, we are talking about an object you could literally carry under your arm.
Exactly. It's a painting that could easily hang in the hallway of your apartment. And yet, Duque intentionally categorizes this specific piece inside a broader series he's working on, a series that's focused exclusively on monuments, massive tourist sites, and colossal historical figures.
It's quite the contrast.
It is. Oh, and a quick fascinating detail from his notes. The visual reference Duque used for this composition actually stems from a photograph taken in a library in Whittier, California, back in October 2018.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But placing this intimate, domestic-sized canvas into a mental category reserved for, like, the pyramids or the Arc de Triomphe, it totally messes with your head.
It does. It
Yeah.
forces this deliberate cognitive dissonance. Your brain is suddenly demanded to give a half-meter canvas the exact same analytical respect and gravity that you would give to a massive architectural wonder.
Yeah, you really have to shift gears.
And the material decisions Duque makes, they immediately establish a clear stance on how he expects you to process this information. Like, take his choice to use fast-drying acrylics over traditional slow-drying oil paints.
Right, because oils can take months, sometimes even a year, to fully cure and dry beneath the surface.
Exactly.
And it really ties the artist to this grueling, layered timeline. By using acrylics, he's choosing speed and, like, modern efficiency.
Yes, the acrylics allow Duke to achieve a distinct chromatic dynamism, an almost urgent energy. Acrylic paint dries through evaporation, meaning the artist has to commit to his choices rapidly.
There's no turning back.
Exactly. There is an immediacy to the medium that flattens the texture slightly, making the image more about the graphic, striking symbol rather than getting lost in the romanticism of thick, painterly brushstrokes. And that material urgency translates directly into what you see on the canvas.
It really does, because visually the content of that half-meter canvas is practically vibrating.
Yeah.
When you look at the image, you are met with five male figures standing completely frontally, facing you directly.
And they are positioned standing on these beautiful, highly detailed golden lotus flowers.
Yes, and they're dressed in these luminous flowing robes, playing with rich, saturated tones of blue, ochre, and pink. They're also wearing these very heavy, elaborate flower garlands around their necks.
Right, the details are striking.
But out of all the aesthetic decisions going on here, there is one that is completely hypnotic. And that is the background.
Ah!
The background is a completely flat, solid, absolute block of blue. There are no temples in the distance, no rolling clouds, no trees, no horizon line,
yeah.
Nothing.
It is an absolute void. And in the visual arts, I mean, the environment usually does a lot of heavy lifting. It gives you all your context. A landscape tells you if it's winter or summer, what country the subjects are in, what historical era you might be looking at.
Right.
But the artist explains in his notes that he needed to actively eliminate what he calls the environmental anecdote.
The environmental anecdote. That is such a brilliant way to frame it. Because it's true, right? If you put a mountain or a village in the background, the human mind will inevitably distract itself by evaluating the mountain.
Oh, absolutely.
We start wondering about the weather or who lives in the village.
By presenting this absolute flat blue void, Duke recognizes that the gaze has a tendency to wander,
yeah.
And he simply gives it nowhere to escape. It's basically sensory deprivation for the eyes.
It's funny you mentioned the background acting as a void because
oh.
It immediately makes me think of audio engineering.
Oh, how so?
Well, when you are editing a vocal track, you often apply a noise gate filter to completely strip away the environmental sounds. You digitally cut out the hum of the air conditioner, the traffic outside, the room echo. And suddenly, that main voice you're listening to is crystal clear, without a single drop of acoustic interference.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Yeah, this painting is doing the exact same thing, just visually. It strips the noise. Here's where it gets really interesting, though.
That is a perfect parallel, yeah. It is a voluntary isolation by the artist. He uses that visual noise gate to force your attention entirely onto the main voice of the painting, which in this case is the highly orchestrated action and the biomechanics of these five figures.
And when you focus on them, you realize that action is orchestrated down to the millimeter. I mean, the composition doesn't just distribute the visual weight equally, like a line of identical soldiers.
No, it's very specific.
Right in the exact center, functioning as the absolute visual and spiritual axis, is the figure of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu.
And to his left, maintaining this incredibly tight spatial relationship, you have Advaita Acharya and Lord Nityananda.
Right.
And completing the group to his right are Gadadhara Pandita and Srivasa Thakura.
And the technical notes really dig into their posture because this is not just a standard portrait of five guys posing rigidly for some historical rendering.
Yeah.
There is a kinetic inertia to it.
Yes.
They aren't static. It feels like a coordinated dance, a collective principle that is manifesting in five distinct forms simultaneously. And you really feel that movement because of their arms. Every single one of them has their arms raised, pointing straight up to the sky.
Raising one's arms is a fascinating biomechanical choice for an artist to highlight because it operates as this universal language.
Yeah, it really does.
It breaks through any cultural, linguistic, or historical border.
Mm-hmm.
Almost everywhere on the planet, across all of human history, raising your arms high above your head communicates two immediate things: absolute surrender and immense, overwhelming joy. Philosophically, in the context of this painting, that physical gesture acts as a direct bridge. It physically connects the earthly material plane that they are standing on with the transcendent infinite sky that they are pointing toward.
I'd also point out the extreme physiological vulnerability of that posture.
Oh, definitely.
Think about it from a purely biological standpoint. When you are in a fight or flight state, your body naturally curls inward to protect your vital organs, right?
Exactly. It's instinct.
But when you raise your arms straight up like that, you leave your entire chest, your heart, and your lungs completely exposed. You are abandoning all defensive postures. You are completely letting go of your ego and your instinct for self-preservation.
Yeah.
They aren't raising their arms because they are begging or asking for something they lack. I mean, they look like they're overflowing with the connection they already possess.
The biomechanics represent the ultimate abandonment of the ego. It's basically a physical manifestation of total spiritual trust.
Hold on, though. As you're describing this total abandonment of ego and this boundless spiritual freedom, I'm realizing there's a huge contradiction here that I'm kind of struggling with.
Okay, what is it?
Well, usually, when artists try to capture the divine or the infinite or this kind of immaterial, boundaryless, spiritual connection, they lean heavily into abstraction, right?
Yes. The instinct is very often to dissolve the physical form.
Exactly. You expect to see smoky edges, ethereal forms, blending colors, light that kind of diffuses into a hazy nothingness. But Duke does the exact opposite here. He chose this incredibly sharp, crisp, direct figuration.
He did.
The lines separating the figures from the blue void are strictly defined. The folds in the robes are almost geometric. Why on earth would he reject abstraction and use such a rigid, defined style for a subject that is supposedly so free and infinite? Doesn't that kind of kill the spiritual vibe?
It's a brilliant observation, and honestly, it cuts right to the core of Duke's aesthetic strategy. Duke himself acknowledges this tension in his notes. He is certainly not a stranger to visual experimentation. In his other painting series, he uses very expressive, chaotic, gestural techniques.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But for this specific piece, he explains that he deliberately imposed what he calls a spiritual canon over a naturalistic canon.
Okay, let's break that down for the listener. A naturalistic canon would be like painting things exactly as they look in the real world. Like obeying the laws of physics.
Precisely. A naturalistic approach would try to mimic exactly how the noon sunlight hits the specific bone structure of these figures' faces, casting realistic shadows. But under this spiritual canon, the light, the volume, and the anatomy itself, they do not respond to real-world physics.
Interesting.
Anatomy here is strictly a vessel for meaning. And to ensure that vessel doesn't break, Duke relies on what he terms formal containment.
Formal containment. Okay, I want to make sure we really grasp this. Think of formal containment like a highly pressurized submarine exploring the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah, okay.
If Duke had used a blurry, abstract, highly experimental style, it would be like putting a flimsy glass window in that submarine.
Huh.
The immense pressure of audience interpretation would just crack the glass, the hysterical message would leak out, and the core meaning would drown in a sea of subjectivity.
Right.
He basically had to build thick, rigid, clearly defined walls to keep the symbol safe.
That submarine analogy perfectly captures the stakes here. Ambiguity creates holes where meaning escapes.
Yeah.
If the figures were smoky and ethereal, every single viewer would interpret something different based on their own mood. He calculatedly sacrificed his own urge for technical showing off. He held back from being wild and experimental to protect the absolute clarity of the symbol.
So the visual clarity had to dictate the art, not expressive chaos, because he's protecting this massive historical message.
Yeah.
And understanding who these figures are is crucial. These aren't just decorative avatars. They are five historical revolutionaries who literally broke down a societal wall and changed the rules of human spirituality.
We really need to contextualize the magnitude of this historical wall, too. We are talking about the Panchatattva, which translates from Sanskrit to the five absolute realities.
Right.
For a very long time in human history, deep contact with spirituality wasn't a public good. It was under a strict monopoly, tightly controlled by priestly elites. To connect with the divine, you needed to know incredibly complex rituals, or you had to be able to read sacred texts in ancient languages that were just completely inaccessible to the common working person.
It was basically a spiritual birth lottery.
Mm.
If you were born into the wrong social caste, or you simply didn't have the money to pay for the ceremonies, it didn't matter if you were the most ethical, devoted person on the planet.
No, it didn't.
The doors to enlightenment were locked. Deep spirituality was an exclusive club, and if you were a regular person, you weren't on the list.
There was a brutal elitism in salvation, and that is the systemic gatekeeping that these five figures dismantled in the 16th century. They essentially democratized the sacred.
Wow.
They established a radical new paradigm, that divine connection didn't require expensive temple ceremonies or decades of studying impenetrable texts. They offered a tool that was entirely public, completely free, and completely devoid of any religious bureaucracy. And that tool was chanting.
It is so fascinating to look at chanting, not just as a religious practice, but as a tool of massive societal disruption.
Mm.
I mean, it completely eliminates the middleman.
It really does.
You don't need to buy a ticket to the temple. You don't even need to be literate. You just need your lungs, your vocal cords, and willpower. So what does this all mean? What were they actually chanting to spark this revolution?
In his accompanying notes, Duke provides the exact mantra that the Panchatattva popularized, which became the engine of the spiritual democratization.
Okay.
It is, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama.
It's brilliant in its rhythmic simplicity. It's basically an open invitation to absolutely anyone to just chant and find that connection. And there's actually a ton of modern neuroscience backing up why this works so well.
Oh, for sure.
When a large group of people chant a rhythmic phrase together, their heart rates actually synchronize. It stimulates the vagus nerve, which lowers anxiety and creates this profound physiological sense of unity.
That makes total sense.
But here is where the deep dive gets really profound. Duke isn't painting this just to give us dusty 16th century history lesson. He brings this historical moment right into your present day. He uses the Sri Panchatattva to actively diagnose the ills of our modern society.
And that is where the true contemporary power of the piece lies. When we analyze his notes, we see him setting up a stark, undeniable contrast. On the canvas, you have these five distinct figures operating in perfect synchronization, bound by a collective joy, completely devoid of any hierarchy or separation.
Right. And then you pull your eyes away from the canvas and look at our modern reality. We are sitting here, digitally hyperconnected to the entire globe through these glowing rectangular screens in our pockets, yet we are emotionally trapped in these solitary, isolated bubbles.
What makes this so compelling as an intellectual exercise is how Duke flips the narrative on what threatens society today. And I should note, whether or not someone prescribes to this specific spiritual path, Duke is using this 16th century framework as a diagnostic tool for our 21st century problems.
Yeah, you don't have to be religious to get the point.
Exactly. His notes argue that the great evils of our current time aren't necessarily political. They are extreme individualism and systematic fragmentation. He suggests that this extreme separation, driven by the sheer chaotic speed of modern information, is exactly what breeds modern violence, depression, and misery.
Because we are so fundamentally disconnected from each other's humanity, visually, the contrast hits you like a ton of bricks.
It really does.
You look at the painting. There are no walls, no barriers between the figures, just perfect joyful synchrony. Then you look around a coffee shop or a subway car today and see everyone walled off in their own silent, fragmented world, staring at screens, wearing noise-canceling headphones.
Duke is essentially suggesting that spirituality, regardless of which cultural tradition it comes from, should function as a social glue rather than a weapon of division or an elite privilege. He is offering this painting, this vibrant depiction of a universal joyous chant, as a visual antidote to the silence and the brutal systemic separation of the modern world.
Man, unraveling all these layers really reveals the hidden architecture of this piece. If you think about the journey we just took, it is incredible how much conceptual ground we've covered, starting from a modest half-meter acrylic canvas.
It really is.
We started with the physical reality of fast-drying plastic paint and the absence of a background, and we unpacked a massive monument to spiritual democratization and a piercing modern social critique.
It perfectly proves Duke's initial point about symbolic density, a highly resistant bridge between the material world and human consciousness. A pure, heavily protected symbol can easily outweigh a giant skyline-dominating block of concrete. The monument isn't the canvas. The monument is the idea contained within it.
It totally shifts the paradigm. I think the next time you walk past a massive historical monument in a city square, you have to stop and ask yourself, are you actually being moved by the depth of the historical idea, or is your brain just being tricked into being impressed by the sheer physical tonnage of the stone?
There is, however, one final thread to pull on here, building on what we've discussed about Duke's highly intentional aesthetic choices, something for you to mull over as you go about the rest of your day.
Oh, I always love a good lingering thought. Let's hear it.
We noted earlier that Jairo Duke had calculatedly sacrificed his own urge for visual experimentation. He constrained his art, using that formal containment, our pressurized submarine, to keep the symbol incredibly clear. He did this to ensure that this historical message of a unifying public song wouldn't be misinterpreted or lost in the noise.
Right, he had to build rigid walls to protect the core message.
Precisely. So, looking at the extreme fragmentation and the collective loneliness of our modern society that Duke critiques, is it possible that this brutal isolation isn't actually born from human malice or political division?
Wait, what do you mean?
What if we are so fragmented simply because we have lost a clear symbol or a common song that we can all share and clearly understand?
Wow. That is a truly monumental question.
Yeah.
Are we just missing our clear symbol amidst all this environmental noise? Or are we just waiting for a song we can all sing together? I think that is the perfect provocative note to end on. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Take care, and we hope you find your own clear symbol out there in the noise.